Allow me to begin with a fairy tale. Once upon a time, there lived a man and his wife who were very unhappy because they had no children. These good people had a little window at the back of their house, which looked mostly into the lovely garden out back, full of all manner of beautiful flowers and vegetables. But the garden was surrounded by a high wall, and no one dared to enter it, for it belonged to a witch of great power, who was feared by the whole world. One day the woman stood at the window overlooking the garden, and there saw a bed full of the finest rampion. The leaves looked so fresh and green that she longed to eat them. The desire grew day by day, and just because she knew she couldn't possibly get any, she pined away and became quite pale and wretched. Then her husband grew alarmed and said, "What ails you, dear wife?" "Oh," she answered, "if I don't get some rampion to eat out of the back garden behind the house, I know I shall die." The man who loved her dearly thought to himself, "Come, rather than let your wife die, you shall fetch her some, no matter what the cost." So at dusk he climbed over the wall into the witch's garden and hastily gathered a handful of rampion leaves. He returned to his wife, and she made them into a salad, which tastes so good that her longing for the forbidden food was greater than ever. If she were to know any peace of mind, there was nothing for it but for her husband to climb over the wall again and fetch some. So at dusk he got, but when he reached the other side, he drew back in terror, for there, standing before him, was the old witch. "How dare you," she said in a wrathful glance, "climb into my garden and steal my rampion like a common thief. You shall suffer for your foolhardiness." "Oh," he implored, "pardon my presumption. Necessity drove me to the deed. My wife saw your rampion from her window and conceived such a desire for it that she surely would have died if her wish had not been gratified." Then the witch's anger was a little appeased, and she said, "If it's as you say, you may take as much rampion as you'd like, but on one condition only, that you give me the child your wife shall shortly bring into the world. All shall go well with it, and I will look after it like a mother." The man in his terror did everything she asked, and soon as the child was born, the witch appeared. Having given it the name of Rapunzel, which is the same as rampion, she carried it off with her. So are pregnancy cravings a mental illness? They certainly have all the characteristics of one, as illustrated in the story that I just told. In seeing the rampion, the wife became so overwhelmed with desire that she experienced a great physical distress. Despite knowing that the witch had tremendous powers, her plea was wretched enough that her poor husband decided to risk his life to get her what she desired. If you are looking for an analog in our American culture, just picture a sleepy husband wandering around the aisles of a 24-hour convenience store at 3 a.m. in his pajamas looking for the exact brand of ice cream that his wife wants. In the Rapunzel story, after eating food, the wife's craving is greater than ever, and she sends him back for more. Her desires were irrational, put her husband's life in danger, and were seemingly beyond the realm of her control. If I were a psychiatrist trying to diagnose her with disease, I would note that she had feelings of hopelessness, poor concentration, difficulty in making decisions, low energy and fatigue, poor appetite, and irritability. According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, I might diagnose her with dysthymia, a chronic mood disorder that falls within the depression spectrum, considered to be less severe than major depressive disorder. My goal today is to share with you some cross-cultural ethnographic research that has been done on pregnancy cravings, displaying their unique nature in a variety of societies and how they have featured in social norms, legend, literature, and law. I will also introduce a few perspectives within medical anthropology, which is what I'm currently specializing in, although I do a little bit of medical anthropology, though epidemiology is my primary focus, that relate to physical and mental illness. And I will ask some critical questions as to whether or not these two theoretical stances proposed by medical anthropology have advanced our understanding of this phenomenon of pregnancy cravings. I'm personally fascinated by pregnancy cravings. There seems to be minimal pattern or logic to the way in which cravings manifest themselves. While not all women experience them, and some women experience them at much higher intensities than others, there is a general cross-cultural trend that allows for, and even some cases encourages, the expression of these cravings. For some, cravings are likened to thirst, and they exhibit extreme anxiety if their cravings are not met. Other women report eating things that they are afraid will harm their children and confess these fears out of shame. Yet they report not being able to resist the cravings. When asked why they yielded, women often report like they feel like an external force was acting upon them. A historical review reveals that cravings have long been understood as a natural part of pregnancy. In the 2nd century AD, renowned Greek physician Soranus authored a treatise, Gynecology, a work that remained influential until the 16th century and continues to have an impact today. Soranus believed that there were three stages of pregnancy: preservation of the injected seed, nausea, dizziness, and cravings, and perfection of the embryo. In the second stage, he described women as having a want of appetite for all, sometimes certain foods, appetite for things not customary. In medieval times, famed rabbi, physician, and philosopher Maimonides adopted the existing Greco-Roman theory that cravings were a result of the imbalance in bodily humors. Women harbored bad liquids in the fold of their stomach at the time of conception from their failure to release menstrual blood. When these liquids penetrated into the stomach, a woman would crave sour and pungent things until the unpleasant juices were vomited. Further, the growth of the fetus reduced the penetration of these liquids into the stomach, and thus, as it makes sense, of course, as the pregnancy progressed, the woman would be less susceptible to cravings and nausea. When a craving is experienced, social customs and norms play an interesting role in determining whether or not the craving is fulfilled. In many parts of the Middle East and North Africa, cravings left unfulfilled are thought to result in a birthmark on the child. Indira smiles. Traditional Jewish sayings warn that the child will have birthmarks in the shape and color of whatever craving she chose to ignore. The craving will be formed in the location where she touched her body while experiencing the craving. These traditions are validated in each successing generation, as women who interpret their birthmarks, the birthmarks their children have, do so by thinking back upon their craving tendencies during pregnancy and share their stories with others. They seek an understanding of a birthmark in a way that makes sense in their cultural model of understanding the world. As one woman expressed, she had craved a guava during pregnancy, but dismissed her desire since the fruit was out of season. Obtaining of it would have been extravagant. She was thus not surprised when her son was born with a guava-shaped birthmark. And actually, I was in Morocco last spring at this time, and I had the privilege of interviewing women on their pregnancy cravings, and I found a really interesting dynamic linguistically. The word for craving in Morocco is wahem.
Yes.
And when you say someone is in the first trimester of pregnancy, you say hiya katwahem. And so it's interesting because the root word for cravings is the same, is used in a different form to express the entire first trimester of pregnancy. And so there really is no differentiation between the first trimester of pregnancy and all that is experienced in that and pregnancy cravings. Therefore, cravings are pretty much considered synonymous with the first trimester. You don't really separate the two experiences. So it's just a really interesting way in looking at how language affects your mentality of the phenomenon and your own situation. Ignored cravings can also cause miscarriage, according to some cultures. In the Talmud, the body of Jewish civil and ceremonial law, if a pregnant woman smells food on the Day of Atonement and feels craving for it, she is to break fast and be given the food until she feels relieved. This is so even if she craves ceremonially unclean foods such as pork, for nothing must stand in the way of saving the life of the child because life is the highest good. She has the final word, and neither experts of the law nor medicine should interfere. Because it is written, the heart knows its own bitterness. Buddhism, Hinduism, and Jainism share similar outlooks on pregnancy cravings. Unlike the direct treatment received in Jewish religious texts, cravings tended to feature substantially in much of Sanskrit literature. The word for cravings, dohada, literally means two-heartedness. often a euphemism for pregnancy, the condition of having a second heart and will is discussed in Sanskrit literature, treatises on medicine, love, and religious literature, where it is often interpreted as a transfer of karmic substances or the coordination of two people's karma. These must be satisfied in order for the prosperous development of the embryo, no matter how they manifest. The Dohada motif is used as a stock embellishment in literature. The blossoming of trees is a kind of birth, but this must be preceded by the fulfillment of a pregnancy fancy. The most prevalent representations are the Bakula tree, which must be sprinkled with wine from the mouths of young women, and the Asoka tree, which must be touched by the foot of a maiden before they will blossom. So essentially, these trees have desires, they have cravings that must be satisfied before they will blossom. And so it's all along with the motif of, you know, before there is the birth of something new, there's a desire that should be satisfied. These whims, imply the Hindu poets, are to be satisfied whatever the cost, even if it is an unwholesome desire, since non-gratification is thought to be harmful to the pregnant woman and her fetus. The community is likewise expected to take part in meeting the needs of a pregnant woman. Literature is replete with anecdotes of stinginess and associated consequences serve as a warning to those who would harbor foods desired by the pregnant woman experiencing Dohada. And I didn't really mention it in my paper here, but there's also in the Sinhalese culture, which is in Sri Lanka, their word for cravings is dola duku. Dola means suffering, and there's an intensity that this word ascribes. And dukkha means craving. So it's a period of intense, almost like suffering with cravings, that's considered. And there's very much a tradition of you needing to meet that craving. And more interestingly, I think that some women also, because there's this expectation that pregnancy has dola duku, they actually feign cravings because it is thought to be a natural part of pregnancy. And that some people will admit that. While lacking the rich religious and cultural milieu that more traditional societies have for cravings, women in Western nations have created a culture of cravings that has grown primarily over time. In a survey of current pregnancy and motherhood magazines, articles, blogs, internet forums, several trends emerge about the culture of cravings in the West. It is commonly said that pregnant women crave pickles and ice cream. A review of popular discourse shows that these two food items are indeed popular, but their prominence masks a variety of other items that are craved. Each pregnancy seems to have its own characteristics. Women also performed unusual acts such as hoarding. When women claim to keep boxes of ho-hos hidden in different locations around her house, or some women put themselves in danger, as in one lady who said that she drove out in a hailstorm to get curly fries, or being vicious about obtaining the desired item, such as knocking people over to get an orange sherbet. There are stories of vegetarians becoming meat lovers, and meat lovers not being able to stand the smell of their favorite foods. Others spent whole days making citrus juices, while still others became physically enraged by the mere smell of chocolate chip cookies baking. In general, the trends were that pregnancy cravings could lead to a change in their state of mind, and women claimed that they felt helpless to control it. These descriptions of powerlessness can be likened to the testimony of individuals with mental illness. Historically, pregnancy was a potentially life-threatening condition. Giving birth was associated with high mortality rates, and since deaths occurred in the community on a pretty regular basis, society was made well aware of the risks that the women were taking in becoming pregnant. The vulnerability that women experienced during this phase of life was recognized by the social code, which gave women a unique position in early modern Germany around the 16th and 17th centuries. The women had incredible power. They were able to influence the political sphere and court systems. Pregnant women would sometimes ask for the lives of criminals to be spared, actually standing outside the courtrooms in large numbers, feeling that they could request mercy because they carried new life in them. They had some success for a period of time in the early 16th century before they were banned from executions for this reason. Pregnant women were also granted clemency in cases where they had broken the law. For example, they could not be prosecuted for stealing fruit and were sometimes pardoned from jail because the prosecutor was afraid that the blood of the unborn child would be on his head if she miscarried in jail. While they were lying in and had cravings for meat, a butcher could be fined if he did not provide them with cheap roast meat. And the same is true as I was looking for these trends, whether or not these trends existed in Morocco, and people were spontaneously sharing with me. You know, if my neighbor is pregnant, when I'm cooking, I have to go bring something to her, because if she smells what I'm cooking and she craves it, but she does not have it, there could be undesirable consequences. So it's a really interesting dynamic of society, too, because you're constantly being aware of who around you is pregnant, and you're involved in their life. So I just think it's really interesting. While the literature reviewed above varied greatly on cultural expectations surrounding cravings, the mode of communication of norms, the extent of representation in art or literary forms, and the role of religion in determining cultural tendencies, each culture, ultimately, in one way or another, dealt with the phenomenon of cravings. In general, cravings are considered to have a biological basis, since the woman's body is rapidly changing during the period of pregnancy. While this physiological function can support the phenomenon of pregnancy cravings, however, it does not explain how pregnancy cravings have come about. Anthropologists disagree on whether or not diseases can be purely determined by biology, and they disagree on the role of culture in this causal mix. They have come up with multiple mechanisms. There's the classic case of the theory of embodiment and the theory that all mental illnesses are essentially biological and hence have a similar prevalence worldwide. According to the theory of embodiment, the body cannot be detached from the mind. The body is not animated by the mind, it is the mind, and thus it thinks for itself. The mind cannot be separated from the physicality of the body. By the very fact of consciousness, embodiment occurs. Renowned anthropologist Margaret Locke formulates her mechanism of embodiment in this manner. A person is a conscious being whose body is the center of dynamic interactions among physical and social surroundings. An individual cognitively infuses these interactions with meaning, and that produces an effect at the molecular level. As such, she is saying that upon receiving external stimuli, the physical process of cognition infuses these stimuli with meaning, which is imprinted upon the molecules of our body. It thus follows that anatomical changes can result from human imagination and activity. So, does everyone follow that? Sort of what the activity and the social surrounding that you have directly imprints itself on your body and not on your mind. So it is opposed to, obviously, what has been argued here today. Locke goes on to state that sickness is not an isolated event or an unfortunate brush with nature. It is a form of communication, the language of the organs through which nature, society, and culture speak simultaneously. An example of... I'll just skip that part. In applying this theory to pregnancy cravings, we could ask the following questions of ourselves. What are the interactions that the pregnant woman is having with her physical and social surroundings? What interactions would be considered legitimate exposures for the outcome of pregnancy cravings? What exactly gets translated between her surroundings and her physical body? How exactly does this whole imprinting process occur? And how does it play out in the form of pregnancy cravings? Most pertinent to our discussion today, how do interactions that happen with our surroundings bypass the mind and directly affect our body, while in fact the majority of our interactions are of a social nature and are not directly sensed in any physiological way? How am I doing on time?
You're fine.
Okay. From what I have observed, the theory of embodiment is often applied retrospectively and without a careful delineation of what the actual mechanism might be. It is applied to data that seem to make sense before a reason that is far from apparent. In the case Oh, and so that's the example that I talked about, didn't talk about. On the other hand, and so not the embodiment theory, there are anthropologists like Arthur Kleinman who posit that mental illness is prevalent in biological, like Arthur Kleinman who posit that mental illness prevalence is biologically grounded and thus consistent across all populations. A key axiom in medical anthropology is the dichotomy between two aspects of sickness, illness and disease. I'm going to give you a little bit of a lesson here. According to Kleinman, disease refers to the malfunctioning of the biological and or physiological process, while illness refers to the psychosocial experience and meaning of perceived disease. Illness includes secondary personal and social responses to a primary malfunctioning in the individual's physiology or psychological status, or both. Illness involves a process of attention, perception, affective response, cognition, and valuation. Essentially, illness is disease plus the cultural recognition of it and reaction towards diseases. Kleinman goes on to offer a mechanism for how this operates. Individuals encounter two types of stimuli. They are either external, such as interpersonal, or internal, such as intra-psychic or somatic. Culture determines the evaluation of these stimuli as stressors. What is perceived as a stressor in one culture might not be perceived as such in another, or there may be a difference in the relative weight attached to each stressor. So if this situation stresses a person from China out a lot, while it doesn't stress a person from America out a lot, he is saying that though they have the same disease process, they will have a different cognitive experience. So these emotions are only known to the person experiencing them via the cognitive processes, perception, labeling, classifying, explaining, evaluating. Therefore, I think you get the gist of that.
Probably about 20 more minutes.
Okay. But the interesting thing is when I read Kleinman's work, the terminology that he uses to describe the illnesses that he feels like his patients are experiencing have actually all been, the book that he wrote was in 1978, and these terms are no longer in use, actually. So it's really interesting. He's pretty sure that he has determined that this, say for this 22-year-old patient, has a certain disorder, but actually these terms are not even used anymore. So what does that mean? I mean, we know, and here I'm coming into the part where I actually really don't know how to interpret pregnancy cravings, because the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, it talks about it is based on an empirical evaluation of mental illness. So it's looking at, instead of like much of medicine and biology, a set of symptoms are derived from a theoretical construction. So when a person has a set of symptoms, you sort of, there's a formulation, you can formulate the mechanism of disease that happens in the body, whereas in mental disorders, it's really based on empirical. It's based on what you see. You're seeing this number of people experiencing these symptoms, and therefore you classify them together. And it's really tricky when you work on that because there's no theoretical foundation for it. And so in thinking about Kleinman's theory, I just am really dissatisfied because I don't think that his mechanism is capable of explaining anything. It's superficial, and it doesn't get at how language affects experience. It doesn't get at how culture creates possibilities for people, and it really doesn't get at the question. It just doesn't satisfy me in terms of the question of causality. And so, in conclusion, I really hope that later on you will ask me a lot of questions about this, because I have a problem when I'm thinking about pregnancy cravings. Are they really are they a pregnancy-induced mental illness? I don't think so. But they're just such an interesting dynamic to pregnancy cravings, and the way in which women express them as they must have something, or there's just, and yet it's so specific. When they describe what they want, they can often name, tell you exactly, I want Ben and Jerry's ice cream. I do not want Hall's ice cream. You know, so how does this come about, and how does it come about to be so different in the various cultures? How do women in Kenya crave dirt, crave, you know, and it's just really interesting to watch, to look at the dynamics cross-culturally, into how people decide, you know, how they crave certain things, how they decide to handle it, the role of the man in society, and I honestly every time end up with more questions than when I started. So, thank you.